This is Sacrilegious with your host, Gary Latterman.
All right, we are back again, and it's good to be back. I'm excited for today's conversation. And so pleased and happy to have my guest, Sunil Agarwal, here with us today. I'll say a few words of introduction and then have a chance to chat with him for the next short while. Dr. Agarwal is a physician and medical geographer. He is a board-certified fellow of both the American Academy of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation and the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine, where he was named a top 20 emerging leader. He's also co-founder and co-director of the Advanced Integrative Medical Science Institute, also known as AIMS. He's past chair of the Integrative Medicine Special Interest Group and an inaugural member of the Safe Use and Psychedelic Assisted Therapies Forum at the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine. He's also a voluntary clinical assistant professor of rehabilitation medicine at the University of Washington School of Medicine and affiliate assistant professor of geography in the University of Washington College of Arts and Sciences. Also, and all with all of that, he continues to maintain a clinical practice and serves as an associate hospice medicine director and on-call palliative physician for Multicare Health System. He's also been qualified as an expert in cannabis and psilocybin medical and religious use in county, state, and federal courts. And he's currently petitioning for a right to try access to psilocybin for patients. Finally, Dr. Agarwal received a Bachelor of Science in Chemistry, Bachelor of Arts in Philosophy, and a minor in Religious Studies from the University of California, Berkeley. Shout out to Religious Studies, and shout out to University of California, if I may. Finally, finishing up, he completed the NIH-supported Medical Scientist Training Program at the University of Washington School of Medicine, where he received a PhD in medical geography and a doctorate of medicine with a pathway certification in global health. So listen, with all of that, it's like, okay, now where do we begin? Listen, thanks so much for being here again. It's great to have a chance to talk with you again.
Thank you, Gary. It's great to be here with you too.
Right on. Can you say a little bit about the case you're involved in currently? Just a little bit of the background and where things are standing. And I'd be curious to hear just as much as you can about sort of that entanglement.
Certainly. Yeah. Well, I have, as you mentioned, I have a palliative care integrative practice at the Ames Institute in Seattle. And in the course of that, I've tried to find ways to improve the access to care for patients who need palliative care, usually patients with serious life-threatening or life-limiting illness. One of the tools that I know that is up and coming, both sort of based on modern clinical studies and traditional use, is psychedelic-assisted therapies to improve palliative care and palliate the distress associated with life-threatening illness and like cancer. And I wanted to be able to offer that to patients. So I had patients in my clinic who have advanced cancer and are looking to find ways outside the conventional model to help to relieve their stress associated with, in one patient's case, a woman in her late 40s who's got stage 4 triple negative breast cancer. And in another case, a woman with a recurrent endometrial cancer. With BRCA positive, meaning high risk for oncogene risk for recurrence. So these patients, these women are really looking for ways to deal with both the existential distress of this illness, the fear of the unknown, what's left behind. In one case, young children. So all of this is what palliative care is a field that sort of tries to maximize care and quality of life for patients such as this. And the tool of psilocybin in palliative care is a very much a one that's, well, I've seen it in use myself during my residency at NYU when the clinical team there was recruiting patients for their study. And I got to also, you know, go to some of those meetings and see how they do it. And I knew that it was at this stage of development and acceptance that might make it eligible for right to try access. And so that's how the case began, because a lawyer contacted me asking if I had anybody that would be interested in this kind of therapy, that she'd written a law review article that suggested that this is a valid pathway for right to try access. A valid pathway for psilocybin in particular, because it had had so many studies and it was ongoing in development. But it can apply to a number of other substances too, like MDMA. But anyway, we were thinking about psilocybin, and seeing that I had these patients, that's how I asked them if they were interested in this type of therapy, if we could make it available for them, and what the risks and benefits of that. We went through an informed consent process as per the laws of our state. And then we asked and asked and asked, and then finally got a no from the DEA that, sorry, you know, no matter what you say, we can't really release this under this. This law doesn't apply to us. We serve older laws than the Right to Try Act. Right to Try Act is at the federal level is, I don't know, a couple of years old, maybe 4 years or so, or 5 years. I don't remember exactly. And there's many state laws. So it really became a matter of a legal question, you know, for the courts to decide whether Right to Try medicines whether this Controlled Substances Act and the rescheduling system should accommodate them or not. And it really is. I mean, we believe it should, and many other substances that we use in palliative care are controlled substances, like morphine, for example, or something like that. And we still find ways to use them. And we use lots of off-label things in palliative care because nobody studies, like there's no on-label use for the use of atropine drops to deal with secretions in people's mouths when they're the last days of life. You get a lot of secretion. So, you know, we're used to that kind of situation of using drugs in different settings because we have this time-sensitive need. And as long as a doctor or a nurse or, you know, medical team is supervising, and as long as we think they could benefit the patient, it's covered. Ditto with hospice. It's like that too. In hospice, anything that you do related to the terminal diagnosis is covered, you know, and that's how it is historically. So we wanted that philosophy to apply to psilocybin. The DEA said, no, we don't really think of it that way. You have to be a researcher to access psilocybin at this point in time. You can't be a clinical doctor. It doesn't matter if this drug has passed phase 1 and phase 2 trials, is ongoing in development, which is basically the actual criteria of the other federal law. So we wanted them to decide that, and we were able to file right basically to the circuit court, Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and because the DEA, a federal agency, that's sort of their next, that's the people above them. So we did that, and in the process of doing that, that was about a year ago, we collected amicus briefs of people in the community who supported our position or were interested in the case. And that included law professors, people who are experts in ethics. There was doctors who were experts in palliative care, like leaders of the field. We even had a medical system, the Evergreen Health System, which is one of the largest providers of hospice and palliative care in the state of Washington. I mean, we had a huge all-star list. And then the most remarkable was that the Attorney General of our state, the Washington State Attorney General, you know, the people's champion, the person that's elected to defend the rights of the people, actually endorsed our case, and then got a number of other attorney generals to do the same, saying, hey, this is part of our medical, like this is the law of our state. We passed this law unanimously. So the court needs to recognize that Washington has the people of Washington have rights. And then they even argued, and then we had a day in court, and the Washington Attorney General's office argued on our behalf, on behalf of my patients, on behalf of my clinic, and on behalf of myself to interpret, help us, you know, convince the panel that this was really acceptable and reasonable, and many other issues. Like, we, you know, that this is a compassionate and right thing to do. So we did that all up, and then about 9 months ago, we got the decision that, sorry, you guys didn't really exhaust all the remedies that you could exhaust at the DEA before we, the judges rule on this. So
wow.
That's kind of, it was kind of an anticlimactic thing. And it made me realize how the, you know, that the system is very, you know, it's not exactly set up to do these kind of things, but you know, the attorneys that had been working pro bono or low bono on this, led by Catherine Tucker, they just persisted. They said, no, this is, we'll be right back. You know, okay, we'll go and do that filing. So they asked the DEA, is this a final decision? The DEA said yes, in a series of letters, like, no, we can't waive this law. This is, we've done everything we can. You're asking us the same question. And we just confirmed this is final, right? And then we asked them for FOIA, Freedom of Information asks, so they could, we can understand how they're interpreting our requests. And they never released those to us. So they sued them over that. And then they sued them again. They took them back to court saying, hey, judges, the DEA says this is a final decision of theirs. So, you know, please review the case again, now that we've exhausted all remedies and these patients don't have much time.
Wow.
So that's kind of where, that's the latest, as of September 6th, 2022, we're waiting to hear if and when the court, and we're asking for the same panel of judges that reviewed our case, you know, and that oral argument is available, you know, publicly, the whole case that was argued before the Ninth Circuit, it's available for anybody of your listeners who want to hear how it was, you know, they did take it seriously. I was happy to see, even though the panel, we weren't sure how they would look at things, but they did ask questions like, how are patients supposed to go about getting this, you know, DEA, if you have a pathway? And they said, no, we don't know. It's not even on their radar. So right. We're hoping the same panel will now recognize that this is a serious issue, and that it actually has to do with a lot of the history of medicine as well, and the FDA, and sort of what came first in the history of regulations when it comes right. to how drugs are and medicines and that kind of thing. Another word for that is pharmacocracy, you know, can rule through drugs. That's a fun word I've been trying to use more of. So the history of drug control is that the main thing is you have to prove safety. The safety was the first bar. And that's sort of the, we're asking, you know, that the right to try law is based on the concept of establishing safety of a drug. Phase one trials have been completed. So phase two, and others are ongoing, but the phase one is always a safety trial. So if something is safe and somebody is dying or terminal or have some kind of high risk of dying, then it's sort of an ethical, compassionate move to let them try anything as long as they have consent with their doctor's permission that the doctors think could benefit them. And as long as it's safe, the government really has no other, should not stand in the way beyond that. And that's kind of what we're asking the court to affirm, that philosophy. And yeah, I mean, it's sort of every day, just it's lots of waiting in this, unfortunately. It's like punctuated by media interviews, punctuated by sure. wait, like long periods of waiting. We had a story in Time magazine a couple of weeks ago, Scientific American before that. So we've definitely raised the conversation at the national level on this issue. And my hope is that that's going to also, you know, have other effects that'll help us, you know, at other policy levels and you know, just a sort of the issue around, you know, the rights of people and how much we, you know, especially those who don't have a lot of time left. And yeah, so that's kind of where things are at with that. If that answers.
Yeah, there's a lot there. And just going... maybe along with the specific case here in terms of terminal cancer and thinking about this in terms of this incredibly sensitive time frame you're working with, and as well as this, you know, these sort of existential personal qualities of these questions, and to get caught up in this, you know, entangled in all of the bureaucratic, medical, and then the, you know, kind of legal dimensions of this too, seems inhuman in a lot of ways, and against the most humane and compassionate thing that one can be doing. But there are many angles to this, obviously, and I'm here with the sacrilegious. So I'm just thinking, how does religious sensibilities and sort of spiritual questions enter in to these debates and proceedings, and or do they not? For reasons that might be strategic, but no, I'm just sort of curious. When we think about this, it's very much framed in terms of medicinal and therapeutic value.
Yes, thank you. That's a really good question. Let me first say regarding the inhumane nature of this proceedings. It definitely my patients have been extremely patient and knew a little bit when they sort of signed up for that they could be a fight and that they would have to talk to, you know, a process and they would, their information would have to go out into the public. And they sort of were willing to do that because they both, one of them said, you know, my legacy, what I want to do is really move this needle forward in my life. It's important to me for patients who will come after me. And of course for myself. And then another patient is a former U.S. attorney, like worked as a federal lawyer, you know, prosecuting on the other sides. And so I thought that was, you know, she kind of understood how these systems work and also was really interested in, you know, helping others who didn't do as well as she is or is doing and has really tried to. So both of them sort of knew that. I still think it's quite ludicrous, this timeline but it is something that they are holding on to and moving forward as best they can. And I'm really, so that's one thing to say. Second thing regarding the spiritual or religious questions that are inherent here, I have to say, I have two things to say about that. One, I can say from the medical, and then I'll say another from the legal. So I think that, first of all, I'm an integrative medicine doctor, provider, practitioner. I think integratively in terms of health, which is really the integrative health is health. It's just, we're so used to physical health being in one box and mental health being in one box and emotional health in a third box, as if that's sort of how health is, but health is really a holistic concept. And the definitions of health at international and, you know, the global health, you heard mentioned, I had a global health background, you know, so people have really thought about this and said, no, you have to include physical, mental, emotional. Sometimes that's lumped in with, you know, mental, with emotional, you can say, and spiritual, and social too, excuse me. So these are you need this full picture that health is the realization of all these dimensions. And the thing is, they don't even all operate on their own either. They all interweave with each other. So there's a dimension of physical health. You want to but that has a, you know, you want your, let's say you have diabetes and you don't want to lose your foot. You know, the existential dimension of, okay, there's a physical issue. You know, make sure the blood supply goes to the foot and that you have sensation, that people are making sure that you're on the right medicines so your sugars are in control. But there is a spiritual dimension of the wholeness of the body, being able to achieve your vision of walking the El Camino Real or taking a pilgrimage to Mecca, or like, what is the physical for you in terms of your spiritual? Or like just the idea of hope. I want to try something to help my physical, and I have a hope that it'll help me. And that the hope is tied to belief. It's tied to faith. It's tied to values. It's tied to all kinds of things that are in my estimation spiritual in its nature. Always there's a spiritual dimension always in physical health, is what I'm sort of saying. You can say that with mental health as well, and the opposites are also true. So it's sort of a That's kind of one thing I want to say, and I reject the notion that we can separate health in these different ways. It really is always integrative, and the need crosses them now. But more particularly, religion is another sort of, that's spiritual, and I think, in my opinion, spiritual health and well-being is part and parcel with the human pursuit of religion or religious experience. It's sort of the fundamental basis. Out of which religion is built, you know, is the spiritual nature of the human, and that's. But I do want to distinguish them in some way, because there is. Usually, we think of religion, we think of a little bit more of institutional, or you know, a larger system. But though you could argue that there's something called direct religious experience too. But anyway, we won't get sidetracked into all of that. But point being that that's the basis, I think, under which religion would then flow, and then in the court case itself. Are the attorney that argued on our behalf cited the Supreme Court case in 2006 called the Unio de Vegetal, Espirito Beneficio, I think is the full name of that church, versus the United States government. It was a 2006 Supreme Court case that ruled that a Brazilian originated church, which is practicing in New Mexico, which is believes that a psychedelic plant brew called ayahuasca is a sacrament, was allowed the right to practice that religion and have access to that ayahuasca under the and exceptions had to be granted to the Controlled Substances Act to accommodate that, is what the court said. And that kind of was a big case in 06, and there's been a number of other such cases, but it was cited in our case because it was an example of how the DEA can, the courts have asked the DEA to not just do a one size fits all for everything, that their laws have exceptions, including in this case, a Schedule One substance. There's not a lot of Schedule One exceptions, and that's sort of the one. Psilocybin is in Schedule One, DMT, which is in ayahuasca, is in Schedule One, LSD that right. we talked about is in Schedule One. So these are the ones. Cannabis is in Schedule One. So all of these things right. are kind of like, well, the court sort of says the DEA can still meet its needs to protect diversion and public safety, but at the same time satisfy the needs of religious freedom of religion. Then, and of course, it's been going on for the last 16 years, and you don't hear like an entire leakage of the UDV church, you know, and on your, you don't turn on your TV and hear, you know, UDV church sending you samples of ayahuasca. Like, none of that's happening. And same thing with the Native American church, which also has some legal precedence to using another Schedule One, mescaline containing peyote. So those in that case, I think that there's both a kind of a concept of how the government accommodates spiritual and religious needs, and I do believe the right to try is really a combination of sort of physical, mental health with spiritual health, because there's a it's a famous quote from some Italian, "Hope springs eternal from the human heart." Like, it's just, this is a, we want to find a way to have hope. I'm not saying that some people also, hey, I want to, it's my time, I want to go, I don't really, my hope is to have a peaceful death. And that's a hope too.
Right.
But if there's a hope, if there's a way that someone can live on, especially if they have, you know, children and other things that they want to be here or whatever they have, then I think it's a spiritual, it's a kind of a, it comes from the spiritual dimension of life. And so that's why I think religious precedent does play a role here in right to try in this way. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Love it. And while I can appreciate, but can get lost in the legal thicket, as you're talking about distinctions between religion and spiritual and some of the conceptual matters, I'm just so proud of you as a religious studies minor. You know, I'm proud of you. I don't know. I just think it's great. And you've got the right language for it.
Tell your audience that your classmate in grad school was my my main advisor at Berkeley, or one of my teachers. That's kind of random. I mean, so we do have a common lineages in this field, and
so many.
Sort of these interesting ways that you see Santa Barbara. So I appreciate your I'm proud that you're proud.
Well, you know, the love fest. It's serious stuff. But conceptually, how we talk about religion and try to make these kinds of clear distinctions and capture some of the nuances is important, because a lot of what you were talking about really is the kind of sensibilities and kind of spiritual qualities that aren't necessarily tied to the Bible or the synagogue or a temple and so on. And so that's, you know, I want to come back to that actually, but.
Yeah, and there's more. Yeah. I'm sorry. I didn't mention like the mystical nature of a psilocybin experience too. That's a whole other topic too, you know, just the nature of the treatment, but yeah. Go
sure. ahead. Well, I mean, I was going to, again, say more immediately, and I don't mean this sort of flippantly or in any trivial sense, but there's a way in which kind of religion in terms of human history has been the medicine for death anxiety. Right? I mean, like religion, notions about the afterlife and so on have served in that role to help people make sense of and live with death. And, you know, in this case, it's a psychoactive substance. Now, what you know, I think, and I assume is accurate, is many different psychoactive substances in many non-Western, non-modern cultures played an integrative role, as you're saying, in the health of the individual and the health of the community in all the ways you've mentioned, you know, the sort of mental, social, physical, again, social body and individual body. But I also think a kind of critical element, as you might guess, coming from me, of all of that is attention to mortality. And that too, as you're saying, is a part of health, you know, to some degree, is being able to, I don't want to sound like I know any answers, but to whatever, be able to face death, to be able to contemplate death, to be able to integrate death into your sense of who you are, you know, and your connections and so on.
That's right. I think the death positivity movement is a huge, fascinating movement happening. Death positive. I don't know if your listeners know that term, but maybe you've talked about it. I mean, it is just it really has big implications at the social level, but also in terms of the practice of what we consider, you know, modern medicine or concurrent system. And ever since medicine became much more critical care and kind of these interventions where, you know, I went through training in this decade and this last, you know, 10, 15 years, it's the amount of like people that we have that sort of skate the line between dead and sort of not fully dead or in between. It's a remarkable and sometimes frightening world. And I think for a system to not be death conscious, you know, and still do that is dangerous. But once we moved into that area, I think it's really important that we do that. So death anxiety is not just a matter for the priest or the shaman or the, the spiritual community. It's death anxiety shows up in the critical and the ICU and in the oncologist's office and the neurologist's office and every time you're trying to heal or work on health, it can be there. So I think it's really a good point. And personally, again, to break the Cartesian split and to bring us back to spiritual, the nature, or, you know, and sometimes people use the word exist. I've been trying to figure out when do I use spiritual, when do I use existential, and what's the difference between the two? And, you know, I think existential is more of obviously comes from the philosophy tradition of, you know, Descartes or Foucault and Sartre and, you know, a bunch of, you know, Camus. And then spiritual is sort of a broader and older term, but they have a similar qualities. There's kind of a Venn diagram of overlap. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, but.
Right. I mean, around questions of meaning, around questions of identity, questions of, again, how do I face death?
How do I face life? How do I face death? Like, it's around meaning. Absolutely. The meaning making is sort of a very important piece. And we've determined that meaning is necessary for a functioning, at least human being, but I think it's beyond. I think meaning is made also by more than human beings as well. Like I always use the example of, since you're in the death field, or, you know, elephants have burial rituals, you know, and so they made meaning of their fellow pack member's life by, you know, and by performing a ritual. So it's not just a human thing. And I think it goes beyond us. Meaning is necessary. It's built into our integral to our DNA or how we function. So if that's the case, and I do think the role that death plays in, or the certitude of knowing of our death, do elephants know that they're going to die? I don't know. Right. But, you know, certainly humans, I've never asked one, but I certainly can. I certainly think humans know, or at least we are taught that. And I think that gives us this, and yet another need to make meaning with the time, given that we have this short time. And, you know, somebody else, I've been really interested in this whole recreation, you know, because what is we're talking about drugs, but there's other things we do for recreation. But the body itself recreates itself all the time. All our cells renew. We get new DNA, new elements. Like we go through renewal processes all the time. And how much of renewal is necessary in order to face, to reboot and sort of come, you know, let the old wash away? Because if you just live in the past all the time, you're not present, you're going to just, you'll die with your back facing the future. So you have to sort of be present. That's the only way that you can, if death has any kind of terminus, it means that like every day you need to live so that you, when you die, you say, I lived. So right. if you never lived before you died, then death sort of, I'm slipping on my words here, but that's sort of what I mean to say, that death gives you that, focuses the life in that way. And I think that's a spiritual existential dimension of our being. And that's, now we can ask those questions in a much more deeper way, especially if we're trying to talk about people's quality of life. I mean, where the heck can we even treat anybody's quality of life if you don't check in with them in terms of their meaning? What gives them meaning in life? And if they have no meaning in life, how the heck are you going to have any kind of quality of life? Right. So I think a meaningless life is devoid of quality. That's kind of what I'm trying to say.
Well, and to just kind of slip it back to where we were, psychoactive drugs, psychedelics can really help in all of those ways. Is that right? With meaning making, with the sense of the present, with the sense of, I don't know about comfort with death, but I don't know, a different perspective on death. It sort of fills all of those check marks.
These are the high level things, right? Because meaning is a very high level, you can say a high level, you know, human trait. Like it comes at the tip of the frontal cortex. It's, you know, a lot of our more advanced features, you know, and then psychedelic substances are working not at the low level, like your skin, you know, not the skin is a low level, but they're not like just, you know, releasing more lipids in your skin so you're more smooth skin. They're releasing things at the neurotransmitter level, very, very, at very high levels of the brain that connect you to very more primitive levels of the brain. So like the connectome, that's what they're now calling it, you know, that there's a connectivity in the neural networks. But then how do you kind of mix it? Some things get sort of siloed off, or you're kind of in trauma loops, or you're kind of, you know, preoccupied or depressed, and you're in kind of a well. So there's not, and you're not learning new things, you're not moving forward. Well, here comes a psychedelic experience, hopefully with preparation setting to maximize it. And boom, all of a sudden that whole thing gets shaken up. And now areas of the brain that are connecting that never have talked to each other in a very long time are getting back into it. So that can help us treat really deep issues like depression, like suicidality, existential distress, OCD, you know, deep trauma syndromes, things that really kind of affect us, religious trauma. I mean, things that really get deep core wounds, injuries, and illnesses that are mortality salient. I think that's kind of where psychedelic substances, like you would be foolish not to have those in your toolkit. You know, it's like, it's like working with, COPD and not carrying around oxygen. It's like, why would you treat a bunch of people with lung disease if you don't carry, you know, a canister of oxygen? Oh, well, we'll just teach them how to breathe deeper. You know, you can do that. Right. But if you don't use the power of chemistry. And I think, you know, as a chemistry person too, I can tell you it's just, to me, it's one of the huge, it's as powerful in invention as fire, or, you know, discovery. I mean, people can compare it like that. It's such a powerful thing. And obviously fire can burn down whole cities, or it can help you, you know, go to the moon, you know? And so I think it's kind of a technology that like that.
Yes.
That has to be held, but yeah.
Yeah. Oh, sorry to interrupt, but the discovery technology, and also back to animals, seems to be kind of deeply rooted in evolution, and you can find examples of animals that also were looking to, well, it seemed to be, you know, looking for substances that can alter their consciousness and behavior and who knows what else. And so it seems this is all very deep, deep, deep rooted, you know, as you've heard the argument. Is this a deep rooted desire to alter our consciousness?
Yeah. And it's, thank for reminding me, humans did not come up with this. We, you know, historically, how did we learn about, I'm drinking some coffee here. How did we learn about coffee is, you know, we saw goats and we watched goats. That's the story that, you know, they're chewing these things, and same thing with cot. And I'm sure many such substances are discovered by looking at what animals are doing. There's a great book called Darwin's Pharmacy. I was going to just plug here by Richard Doyle, Pennsylvania State University professor. I don't know, you might know him or heard of him, but he's brilliant. And he thinks that like these kinds of substances helped to improve eloquence, and that the role is in sexual selection, that you become more eloquent when your brain is a little bit more shook up a little bit and you can sing a better song, which might help you be more attractive to a mate. Because people always ask the question, well, how is it a survival advantage if somebody is tripping, you know, animals tripping, then the lion is going to come and eat them while they're incapacitated. But if you find a safe place to do that, and then you come out and you can sing a better song than your partner, then you might get a better mate and your genes can pass on. I mean, you do have to look at the evolutionary story here, because the only evolutionary story that we have is these are bad and demonic, and they should have never been created. They were the devil's weed. Like, these were put on earth to tempt us and drive us away from heaven, you know, from God. I mean, that's literally the original. I don't think there's any caveats to that. That's pretty
not
much.
At all. No,
okay.
Truly, and that's what's been hammered home to many of us for the from 20th and into the 21st century.
Yeah, it's starting in the 16th century. I mean, if you look at the Inquisition documents of the missionaries that were accompanied the Spaniards into like, imagine going to the Aztec and Mayan cultures and seeing all these, you know, mushrooms and all kinds of things that they used in their rituals, entheogens, and they just like, what is this? And all they wrote is that this is whatever this is we just got through burning all the witches in Europe on this stuff, so we're going to just keep doing it here. So that's also an interesting, I think the story there about witches and demonism is kind of, that's why, well, if we apply science, if we apply history, archaeology, psychology, you start to see, no, actually, this is a big part of the human and evolutionary story. And I wanted to just say that, you know, that professor at in Arizona, Winkelmann, Michael Winkelmann, he wrote a paper with a Brazilian anthropologist where they said, you know, we think psilocybin was necessary for the development of the social ecological niche in Homo sapiens, that we needed this to actually do what we're doing now, which is like, you know, sitting around and talking and being friendly and not just sort of being in these like individual self-contained tribes that, you know, never got together. So that's really, these are real theories. These are actual important questions around. So yeah, and that's very much tied to religion. So that's why I want to bring it back to religion.
Well, back, and you're right, historically, to go way beyond, you know, American history in my lifetime and look at the ways in which power has been deployed around various psychoactive substances, including these entheogens that are particularly threatening to Christianity. Especially monotheistic traditions in general.
I would say felt it to be threatening to Christianity, because if you read Brian Marescu's book, he says, no, this is not threatening to Christianity. This is the foundation of early Christianity.
Truly. Yeah. Well, I mean, the early history is worth exploring. And I think there are lots of questions, but certainly with the rise of the church and Protestantism, it's a different story. But still, it's, but just also, to make it thicker, is to, of course, think about those psychoactive substances that sort of made their way through. You mentioned coffee, or like tobacco, or you know, forms of cocoa, or, you know, is all kinds of other ways in which colonialism, capitalism, medicine, we're all kind of appropriating a lot of these indigenous substances that had very profound ritual religious use, and then, you know, they get translated and commodified, but you know, I like to think there are, as I think you do too, there are the religion remains, the sacred remains, to plug my own book.
Yeah, I'd love to read that. Well, I'm curious about that, because I do think that psychoactive substances like stimulants, like coffee or cocoa, I mean, coca leaves is a different story because it's really a revered plant. But let's say coffee, which is available on every street corner. It's the most widely used psychoactive substance in the world, actually, is caffeine, is what I've seen people, when people do accounts of this. But I think that anything, this is what I'm kind of playing with the idea that anything that sort of is psychoactive in any way is sort of a derivative or harkens back to the fundamental psychoactivity of the drug that you take that completely blows your mind, you know, that's completely deeply entheogenic and gives you a vision of God or whatever it is, or changes your whole set. I mean, that's really the most powerful drugs, powerful, quote unquote, meaning, you know, in terms of like, you know, 5-methoxy DMT or things like in that category. So I think every other drug is sort of a soft stand that's a psychoactive is kind of may harken back to that deeper sort of thing that's in our evolutionary history of drugs turning you into more religious or spiritual beings. That's just encoded into our DNA, let's say. So that means that everything may have some, there could be a meaning dimension, a spiritual dimension to drinking coffee, you know, that it's there. And because we prize the substances that change our consciousness in some way. But there's something powerful to that, because we normally, you know, in everyday life, you know, you touch an inanimate object, it's not like making me more, you know, happy or, you know, internally, am I feeling more energized to run a marathon? But these special substances that are psychoactive in this way, I think there's a natural tendency to give a story around it, to infuse it with meaning, even if that meaning is, hey, you know, take a break from work, smoke a cigarette, and, you know, or go feel like you're out in the Joe Camel country, you know, or with the Marlboro Man and experiencing, you know, the home on the range with your cigarette or your whatever the things that Madison Avenue did to drugs. That's actually part of the mythic dimension that, you know, we all want some stories associated with our psychoactivity. That's what I'm, and maybe that's true for other drugs, but especially psychoactives. So not just entheogens. I think entheogens sort of are the creme de la creme of psychoactives.
We're on the same page completely, you know, and our job is to help people understand they're being religious in ways they may not recognize. For many is sacrilegious, but listen, I know we don't have a lot of time, we're going to have to do more of this another time, but I'm going to bring it back to pharmacracy.
Pharmacracy, yes.
And one of my favorite terms and concepts these days is the pharmaceuticalization of culture. Yeah. And to think about psychoactive, you know, prescription pills, psychopharmacological pills that are a part of our daily lives. And what you were just saying to this substance, and, you know, and see what you think on that score, so to speak. because for me, I'm in the middle of writing about, you know, sort of the pharmaceuticals and religious spiritual sensibilities, but it's a stretch. Although I think there's some evidence, an interesting evidence that does demonstrate an interesting overlap.
Interesting. I'd love to hear. I mean, I'm so excited to become your number one fan. Yeah. I'm so. I think you've had a chance to really think about these things and reflect on them. And you're asking, these are really important questions. You know, we've had so much of a kind of blind spot around drugs and substances in many fields of scholarship because of the drug war and the pharmacocracy and everything. And it's nice to be able to kind of think broadly. And I would say also the stranglehold or the power of the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, it is worth noting that pharma, I've read this somewhere, it's the most profitable industry in the history of industries. Like the return on investment, like, you know, let's say you want to, you know, extract diamonds, you know, however much money you put into that field and how much you get back. It's just all these different things and the ratios that you can do, but the amount of money you put in to how much you get out in pharma is greater than anything that humans have ever done. So it has a special special status in capitalism, you know, in late stage and in neoliberal formations. That's number one. Number two, within pharmaceuticals field, the psychopharmaceuticals, the ones that do affect mood and consciousness and those kinds of things, are often, if not only, the most highly selling ones. Like they're the ones that of their, so they're the top of the top of the food. And when it comes to, and there's a really good critic on this is Richard D. Grandpre. He's a PhD in psychopharmacology at, forgot where he's at now, but he had a book called The Cult of Pharmacology a couple of years ago, which is really good and goes into some of this. Yeah. He's a PhD in psychopharmacology and he used to do Adbusters magazine. So he kind of understood, you know, image and drug and right. all that stuff. It's really important. So I do think that they are also tapping into this, again, this kind of this entheogenic story of the drug as, and it's not just, this is like cross-cultural. There's like, I was in India this summer, you know, there's like there's lots of myths around a god going and finding a plant that cures the ailments or going on a quest and finding a mythic plant medicine, you know? So it's a deep myth or a mythic dimension of humans to find, you know, the pill to cure your ills. You know, it's just a modern version of the same, of the god finding something in the wilderness. And in this case, the god is your, you know, your pharmacy lab. Right. And they're investors, and those are their puzzles or something.
One of my favorite recent books that I've read, even though it's not so recent, is called On Speed, The Many Lives of Amphetamine Nicholas Rasmussen. And
I saw that title. I'm curious about that one.
Well, it's worth the read, again, cause just tapping into everything that you're saying. And particularly focused on sort of many lives of speed and amphetamine and how we can't kill that drug. It is here to stay.
That's why we need coca. We need coca leaves back in our circulation. And we'll see why they're revered. Chewing gum. We need stimulants are part of, that's how the people in the South America survived the Andes. You need stimulants to sort of get your hotspot and take all those high hills and mountains. I just had some friends who came back from Peru and they talked about how essential that is just to make it in those areas. So I think it's just stimulants are necessary, but how to do it safely. I think all psychoactives, psychoactive agents is a necessary part of our need to function and to fulfill our destiny or whatever, you know. So it's, to me, public health is going to be about the future is like, how do we satisfy those needs safely, safe as possible while respecting people's rights and that kind of thing, but also acknowledging that this is a drive. This is a, you know, that comes out of our spiritual purpose to find meaning and to recreate, which is also part of meaning making. So that's kind of, I think, the pretty bow I would tie on that. But I wanted to also say about psychopharmaceuticals. I mean, antidepressants is a whole other topic we could go on about in particular. There's a really great article by a guy named David Lenson. He wrote On Drugs. This is a very famous, he's like you, he was a literature professor who really got into thinking about drugs and you know, meaning. And then he wrote a chapter in Mitch Earlywine's book on mind-altering drugs called Corporate Highs, Corporeal Lows. And he talked about his experience of taking Prozac or Zoloft or one of the SSRIs, I can't remember what. But it was interesting, like, corporate highs. You know, he was interested, like, in which we embody the drug that's, we're also embodying the sort of the corporate production of the drug. But then, you know, what everyone says about these drugs is that they limit both your highs and your lows. So the depresses won't go as low, but the joys won't go as high. So you're kind of in this more of a, you can say, like, zombified. I mean, not to use that term. I'm not saying that people are zombies who use these drugs, but I'm saying that there's a restricted range that happens. And it's sort of like there's no free lunch. Well, if you don't want as much lows, we'll sort of stop that. But you also don't want as much, you also won't get as many highs. And maybe that's a good deal for some time for somebody that is seriously suffering. But to think that that's sort of the end all and be all of treatment of depression, that sort of it all ends there and forevermore ye shall be on this drug, is an extreme desecration of the field of psychology and human flourishing. Like this book, Lost Connections, that Johan Hari has written. You know, he's a journalist in the UK. And you know, there's like so many other things that we know help depression, from connection to meaningfulness at work, to certain types of environments, to like many, many, many things. Right. Exercise. I mean, huge range of things. And so the idea that we're just going to go with a pill, and then that's really all it is, everything else is sort of extra fluff, that is also speaks to a certain type of, I don't know if it's a, human demand, or it's a sort of a cultural understanding that a pill for every ill, that it's, you just need a pill. I don't need all this. I don't need to like get a better. And I think, but what people argue is that's because to challenge your working conditions, you have to challenge the structure of the corporation that made the pill for you. And nobody's going to sell you something that's going to challenge you to have you challenge their very business model that they produced it under.
Well, right.
That's sort of the interesting thing. So to me, the governments need to take more control over these industries and say, no, you serve us. We don't serve you. Right now, we serve them because they fund so much of our lobbying. But not all countries do that. India, Brazil, they took different approaches to pharmaceuticals and saying, no, we appreciate what you're doing. We've given you grants, but we're also going to be taking some of your, we're going to be putting this to use for people and not just for your shareholders. So I think it's you can't talk about that without talking about kind of corporate health care and public health. So that's sort of the flip side of that. Otherwise, the pharma is always going to win the day when it comes to marketing. You're never going to, you'll get blanketed by ads and, you know, and that's why everyone's really worried about psychedelics and corporatism for good reason. I mean, what is that going to look like? You know, the traditional use I was describing, you didn't have to, if mushrooms back in the days of the savannah, we had to pay somebody a huge amount of money, we would have maybe never evolved into the social cognitive niche. It was like, well, this is available. This is here. I was already picking berries and here they are. So let's just bring them back. It wasn't like, oh, let me sell off my whole half of my village and all of my goods so I could have one dose of,
Sure. I tie it to that pharmaceuticalization of our lives and culture, where every aspect of health is intertwined with pharmaceuticals that you know, promise to give us what we're lacking or missing or need, in spite of the dangers or side effects and all of that. And it's you know, it's quite ubiquitous isn't even the right word. It really has changed our way of thinking. It's changed our way of thinking about our bodies and health and all of that. And certainly the psychedelic piece into the future is going to be a real, I think, shitstorm. You know, I think it's going to be kinds of interest.
That's to be expected, I guess. You know, like right. They are disruptive. They're very disruptive. And that's sort of, they were so disruptive that the government banned them, you know, completely in the late 60s, early 70s. That's sort of how they dealt with the disruption back then. But now we can no longer, now we won't be able to do that much longer. So how are we going to, they didn't stop becoming disruptive. You know, they we're just going to have to find a different way and hopefully learn from them in a harmonious way. That's sort of my, you know, as a medical geographer, I think when health geographer, how do we kind of make peace with the environment? How do we maximize our health and at the same time our relationship to the environment? So I see this as sort of just part of being human, part of being alive on the planet. So we need to kind of find a way to sort of manage this. I do think the economics really does matter, and I'm hopeful. I don't know. I there's a lot of things happening. It's not just pharmaceuticalization, and that's kind of, you know, in the spiritual and religious world, and it's policy. You know, I was going to say I'm a chemist. I also have chemistry background, and I attend these meetings of like chemistry Olympiads, and I get to see all these young people getting into chemistry careers, and you know, they're just really fascinated by the molecules. They don't care that like, oh, you know, this is like some drug that's going to be, you know, highly expensive and exclusive, $10,000 a dose. It's like, no, I want to just make the drug and I don't really care. Like there's a kind of a loss of ethics also in science, in the machine, in the sort of the intellectual powerhouses of the pharma industry, where they're just sort of like, oh, I'm just going to, you know, solicit myself for my ability to make a drug. I am not responsible for what's done with that drug, or I just put the chemical atoms together, man, just leave me alone. Like, and I think that's kind of that's also an alienation piece that I think also lies at the heart of this, because I've worked in pharma. You know, I should also mention that, like, I did internships in biopharmaceutical companies as a college student, and I've seen kind of that side of it. And it's sort of again, for me, it all comes back down to policy. You know, a certain type, what is the policy environment that you're in? And right now, the incentives are towards profit making at the max. That's really all you want to do. And the government has set it up like that. If they had, oh, we're going to have in this industry 10% because you're just doing such good things for people, you know, and we really want to, just like farmers get subsidies. You guys feed us. So every time you have bad crops, we'll take care of you, because we don't want you to just go under because there was a bad frost that year. We care about you enough. You're doing such an important service. So we'll help you. And I think that's kind of a managed way. I think if we start doing more of those kinds of things, there'll be less of these perverse incentives. That's my Pollyanna dream. You tell me. Yeah.
Hey, I'm all for dreamers, and we got a dream, because it's pretty shitty. And but we're working hard, and the work you're doing is amazing. So, you know, definitely want to end on a note of gratitude, because your perspective in terms of, you know, it sounds like both your personal journey and background, but also, you know, just from all you see, where you are now is so important and critical, I think, to helping, as we've been talking about, shape the discourse or the language, the way we communicate about these things. And so I'm a big fan of yours.
Much gratitude in return, my friend. I'm so grateful that we connected, and you're doing what you're doing, and it sort of, we can work together and collaborate and learn from each other. I think it's really important that religious studies goes beyond and comes into the larger humanities, the larger health sciences, and you know, everything, like cosmology, everything, because it really is. I've also want to say that I read that the Protestant Reformation led to huge changes in society, like different relationship to the printing press, different relationship to even healthcare industries. It wasn't just, it was a big shift. And so my hope is that something like that, if psychedelics are as powerful on the spiritual religious level as we are talking about, and if there's more awareness, presumably their reintroduction in this process could lead to some kind of reformation in the same way that you know, the Protestant Reformation, or maybe different, I don't know, but some people are calling that the entheogenic Reformation or entheogen Reformation. So if that's happening, or will happen, or what will that do to science, to government, to industry, like those kinds of the same way that you can ask the questions, what did the Protestant Reformation do to, you know? And I've seen, like, places took a lot more. I was reading articles about this, like how it changed the practice of medicine, that there was more these hospitals like St. Bartholomew's got set up in the UK, and later on the National Health Service took over those hospitals. But it was like a much more like, okay, we're going to take charge of this on our own. You know, the needs of the health of the population, there was more of a service oriented thing. So I'm kind of, That's kind of an interesting question for me.
That's hopeful too. There are a lot of blood in that Protestant Reformation, but also, you know, I love the psychedelic Reformation and all that. But a
lot of blood. Yeah, but, well, we have a lot of prisoners in the psychedelic. There's lots of blood there too.
There's so much to talk about.
You're a Grateful Dead guy, so you probably know when the Cheney released national secure, you know, armed troops to a Grateful Dead show, you know, to capture, there was a whole like posse comitatus type craziness. Like we've gone to war domestically with concert goers.
You know? Yeah, sure. No, exactly. Really unpleasant events from this history, but, but the history goes on and we can change it. So let's, again, thanks a lot. And we'll end it here, Sunil. Thank you.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.